Yeah, so the most pressing large news item in recent months has been the war in Gaza. Israel are now saying that the war's, you know, they're going to carry on the war right through 2024. Protests are continuing right around the world, including lots of British cities. There's more protests planned. You know, we had talked about this quite a bit in the past, so I'm not going to dwell on this. I'm just going to go through some highlights. Well, I'm not sure if highlights is the right word. Lowlights, I guess. So, 2023, what else? Donald Trump became the first former president to face criminal federal charges. He's got a total of 91 charges facing him across four federal and state cases. And now two states, Colorado and Maine, have made history by banning him from running in the state primaries. And in spite of all that, he's still the favorite to win. Meanwhile, Ukraine will be looking keenly at the November US elections, because if Trump wins, he'll probably stop all aid to Ukraine. I think increasingly there must be people taking the view that this would actually be the best thing. Sad though it is, because it would force a surrender or at very least a ceasefire, which would at least stop the fighting. Ukraine itself also has an election looming, but I think there's some question about whether Zelensky is going to allow it. He's now been falling out with all his generals. The signs that he's losing popularity. Is he going to allow these elections, or is he going to go sort of go the autocratic route? Wouldn't be the first time in Ukraine. Meanwhile, Finland joined NATO. Sweden wanted to join NATO too, but is being blocked by Hungary and Turkey. I think I haven't looked into that, but there are things that Hungary and Turkey, there are concessions that both of them want out of the EU. There was all that malarkey with Putin and the big challenge from Yevgeny Prigozhin in what must be one of the bizarrest, almost coups of modern times. That looked like a straight up march on Moscow and then fizzled out as soon as it had started, and finished off a month or so later with a, in quotes, accidental plane crash. Strange times. One that you might not have, might have escaped notice, but which is absolutely crucial in terms of oil and gas supplies, is Azerbaijan launching a lightning strike against the an Armenian enclave inside eastern Azerbaijan, Nagorno-Karabakh. There's a long history to this, going back to the fall of the Soviet regime. So in previous encounters, Armenia's won because it's been backed by Russia. This time, Russia's busy elsewhere, so Azerbaijan took the opportunity to evict all the ethnic Armenians from that enclave. And why this is significant is this is probably a flashpoint for another war in 2024, because Azerbaijan is determined to make an east-west link to Turkey to get all its oil and gas out from Baku to the west. So Azerbaijan, it's quite the geopolitics around here is pretty fascinating. They're Shia Islamists in Azerbaijan, and they're on the northern border of Iran, but they're sworn enemies because Azerbaijan wants to basically take over part a big chunk of northern Iran, which is mostly ethnic Azeris. So there's just strings and levers being pulled all over that area. Another area where there's a possible war, although I personally doubt it, is huge new oil fields were discovered off the coast of Guyana, and now Venezuela is suddenly remembering that it had some kind of historic claim to part of Guyana, and so the pundits are excitedly talking about a possible war in South America. But well, I don't know, you can talk about that. Big talking point in the sort of advanced capitalist countries was generative AI, particularly ChatGPT this year. Even the tech insiders said they weren't prepared for just how damn good these large language modules were. Nobody expected neural networks to be anything but pale imitations of the human brain, and the actual brain-like performance of these things has pretty much blown everyone away this past year. Not everyone is happy, of course. Those who think they might lose their jobs. Speaking personally, I suspect my job has just fallen off a cliff, precisely because of ChatGPT. And in relation to AI, the chip maker that makes these GPU chips that are used in AI is it used to make chips for games consoles. This is Nvidia. Now, because of AI, its stock has gone up 240% in this last year. Other stocks that have gone back up after 2022's corrections are crypto, tech, tech sector, Tesla, foreign cruises. So it's nice to know that some people have got lots of money to burn. And obesity drugs was the big new thing in 2023. This last year, we also saw the second biggest bank failure in the US. Silicon Valley Bank went down, along with Signature Bank, that followed by First Republic Bank, forcing the Fed to step in and bail out depositors. In a move, I think it's quite typical. This is quite typical of the sort of mixed economy that the US actually is, as opposed to the laissez-faire free market that its right-wing nutjobs think it is. Shortly after that, Credit Suisse went under. These things don't really affect us on a day-to-day level, but the tsunami tends to come months down the road when there's suddenly a lack of jobs and we wonder why. On the environmental front, we had wildfires in Hawaii, deadliest in the US for a century, turning the heat up on anyone who still wants to argue that global warming is not a thing. Meanwhile, 2023 was the hottest on record. Again, every year seems to be the hottest on record. We had earthquakes in Turkey and Syria, huge earthquakes, about 60,000 killed, and other earthquakes in Morocco and Afghanistan. At the time of the Turkey earthquake, a lot of people were saying that because of the well-known poor quality of housing stock in Turkey, particularly the cheap areas, the villages in the cheap areas of Istanbul.
Happy New Year.
But some people were saying that this might mean that there was an electoral upset and that Recep Erdogan would get booted out. Well, he didn't. He got re-elected quite handsomely, so clearly the voters weren't too upset by the earthquakes in that respect. And speaking of elections and also of nut jobs, there's Argentina with an inflation rate of 160%. This is for the classic reason that they've been printing pesos like they were going out of fashion in order to pay debts that they couldn't finance by borrowing from overseas because no one would lend them any money. That they've just elected this chainsaw-wielding nutter called Javier Milei, who's immediately devalued the peso by 50% and slashed public spending, and he also wants to abolish the central bank and make the dollar the national currency, even though dollars are really hard to get in Argentina. So how that's going to work is anyone's guess. So other elections, Geert Wilders in the Netherlands, his far-right candidate, has finally got into power in traditionally quite liberal Netherlands. New Zealand has gone right-wing after Jacinda Ardern. I believe that's right. Moggy can confirm or deny that. Greece has gone right-wing too, as has Finland. Although Poland has gone centre-left last year. And in Spain, the sort of left took power in a coalition with Catalan separatists in Thailand, the reformist Move Forward Party won something like an 80% majority at the polls, but was kept out of power by the royals, by royal diktat, essentially, that said, we're not having these people as government, and they gave power to the minority right-wing party instead. So three cheers for monarchies. And I'll probably just leave it there, but just say that 2024 is the year for elections, and cephalologists in particular. And here's something I just picked up today, that at the start of the 20th century, hardly anyone in the world voted. Even in countries where voting was possible, not many people actually could vote. In 2024, it's a historic record. There are 4.2 billion people in 76 countries who will have the opportunity to vote in some kind of nationwide elections. This is from The Economist today. How many of these elections are actually fair is quite another matter. They have their own research unit says that of 71 countries with elections, only 43 will be fair, and of the countries that it thinks have dodgy or slightly dodgy electoral processes, it includes Brazil, India, Indonesia, and interestingly, the United States. And four which are outright not fair: Russia, Bangladesh, Pakistan, and Mexico. Then, of course, there's the Taiwan election coming up in, I think, February, that the Chinese will be looking very closely at. So there we go. That's my quick, super quick roundup, most of which I pinched out of The Economist, so I'm not going to say that I did tons of research with this, but there you go. I thought that might be enough to get the ball rolling. So, comments, anybody? Okay, Brian's first. Off you go.
Yeah. I don't think you mentioned the housing crisis that's just cropped up now in China. The chickens come home to roost in regards to the excessive houses and actual cities that's been built in China. The main housing organization in China has currently filed for bankruptcy. And that's a big, really big thing for the Chinese government to allow their housing organization to file for bankruptcy. But it's occurred. Well, there have been further roll-ups we've yet to see. Well, there's my little bit anyway for 2024.
Okay, yeah, thanks for that, Brian. That's true. I haven't been following that too closely, but that housing thing has been going on for a while, though, isn't it, in China? Okay.
Yeah, it's been a crisis in housing in China for years, hasn't it? But I mean, it's now, you know, like I said, chicken has actually come home to roost because they filed for bankruptcy. What it means is that the Chinese Communist Party hasn't got any main housing organization where they can turn around and direct efforts and all the rest of it. No, that's not going to occur anymore. No, and what will actually occur, we'll just have to wait and see.
Okay, thanks, Brian. Andrew, next.
Oh, thanks, Paddy. Can you hear me okay?
Yep.
Yep, good. I don't really want to make a very profound sort of point, but just while you were talking about the sweep of some of the, you know, the sort of party political changes across the world, and sort of the changes from left wing governments and right wing governments and vice versa. And especially when you mentioned one or two of them that I've been hearing about, like the situation in Argentina and the potential return of Trump. And then also the paradox of that Poland, flip-flopping back to a more kind of centre-left situation, and the Netherlands then going with this crazy guy called Geert Wilders, who probably 10-15 years ago was considered to be an absolute nutcase. I sort of lose the will, really, because from my perspective and our perspective, having just gone through the Christmas sort of pantomime, charade, whatever, which I never enjoy, I just sort of can't help like wondering why, people will do this, and basically using a terrible cliche, but it just feels like turkeys voting for Christmas, without ever kind of questioning that there must be a better way than this, because they've tried this left wing, right wing flip flop so many times. And I think that probably the minute, the one that really does just kind of highlight it to an extreme is Argentina. When I can't sleep at night, I listen to the BBC World Service. And sometimes, actually, the coverage is very good, far more informative than you'd ever hear on something like the Today programme in the morning, which I've given up on now. And even the correspondents who are reporting, critically reporting, one of whom actually... I sort of know personally. I used to know her personally, Katvina. She was a member of the Revolutionary Communist Group that I was on the fringes of about nearly 40 years ago now. 35 years ago. And she's an incredibly kind of, left type of person, and she doesn't really try to hide it. She's reporting on the Argentina situation in South America, and like she's almost kind of crying about it and laughing at the same time. I just wonder what's going on there, with this sort of crazy kind of world situation. Even the Christians have kind of given up on Christianity almost now, and they're talking about this broken world. With what's going on in the so-called Holy Land and so on. I just can't believe that people cannot see that there must be a better way. Anyway, that's a bit of a heartfelt comment from Andy. So there we are.
Okay, thanks, Andy. Well, I don't think any of us here are going to sort of disagree with you, really, are we? I mean, yeah. But this is without me even mentioning the British election that might come up this year, but it's just more of the same, more flip-flopping. I think the problem with us is we're sort of what you might call sort of professionals. We take a professional interest in politics, and so we, by and large, we tend to be fairly knowledgeable about it. But most voters, it's a sort of peripheral thing to their lives. The amount of attention they give it and the thought that they give it is probably, pretty superficial. There's enough, they've got enough troubles going on. The idea of being asked to sort of choose which bunch of crooks should be in charge next time. I suspect it's not something that people give a lot of thought to in a lot of cases. Maybe I'm wrong, I don't know, but the idea of people sort of burning midnight candle wax, sort of teasing out the differences between, the major capitalist parties and sort of, forensically examining their manifestos. I struggle to believe that. I struggle to believe that's what people really do. I think probably most people don't take it that seriously. They don't. They know it's not going to really do anything, so they don't devote a lot of thought to it. Okay, Howard, come and say something useful.
Not sure about useful. I wanted to comment on the fact that I thought you said something useful on a number of things, but in particular, what you said about the Azerbaijan-Armenia affair. We didn't hear a lot about it, really, did we? In the media, it sort of came and went very quickly, and one really wondered what it was all about. I think probably there was a lot more sort of killing and so on than we know about, we were left wondering sort of why it happened when it did. The economic motive was an interesting thing. It's not something I knew about at all. You said you got most of this information from the Economist. I was wondering if they said that as well, that it was all about Azerbaijan having a sort of channel through to Turkey, whereby it could sell its oil in the West. Or is that something that you sort of worked out for yourself from other sources?
They probably have covered it, Howard. I can't remember when. It's stuff I've got from other sources. But it's quite interesting. If you look at a map of where Azerbaijan is, it's weird. It's in two pieces. There's the eastern Azerbaijan, which is the big bit, and that's got this little sort of cell of Nagorno-Karabakh inside it, which belongs to Armenia. And then you've got western Azerbaijan, which is this separate enclave and driven right down through the middle of both of them, in between both of them, is this wedge of Armenia. So with the narrow end at the bottom, and the history of pipelines going from Baku, where all the Caspian Sea oil and gas is, the pipelines have had to go through Azerbaijan over to the north to get over Nagorno-Karabakh, north again to get into Georgia, to get over the top of Armenia, to go west down to Turkey, and to get out to the Mediterranean. And also there's sort of ethnic divisions. The Azerbaijanis talk about, well, I think Erdogan in Turkey described Turkey and Azerbaijan as one people, two states. So there's a really strong sort of ethnic affinity that they've got. But, you know, I don't think they would go to war over that. I think it's, you know, we know, don't we? We tend to look for the materialist explanation. And Baku and the Caspian Sea oil and gas thing. Azerbaijan has got as much oil as Norway. It could provide, I think it's 9% of oil and gas to the EU. Before the Ukrainian invasion, you know, that was neither here nor there, really, so it didn't matter that much. But of course now that's a huge thing. So, you know, again, it's why Israel is becoming important, because they've got big gas fields now that have only just been developed. So this is, you know, it's like, I suppose you can imagine the EU is like the spider, sort of with this web going through Eastern Europe and Central Asia, sort of drawing on its threads and drawing on these pipelines and gas lines to get energy to the West, now that it can't get that stuff from Russia. And so we're suddenly seeing things like, and yeah, it is weird that it wasn't really in the news. It sort of flashed by, and then you saw some report about all the inhabitants of Nagorno-Karabakh had to basically pack up in satchels and backpacks and hoof it west into Armenia proper. They just got unceremoniously booted out after 30 years of having claimed a sort of independence. Yeah, it's true. It wasn't really in the Western news. It's just not something that Western news media paid much attention to. Far less than for example, when the, Russia invaded Georgia, that was quite in the news, and obviously Ukraine's never been out of the news.
Yeah, can I just add, Paddy, that, sorry, I can see that Andy wants to come in, but can I just add, there was one other thing I wanted to mention arising from your earlier comments. You talked about the various nut jobs who've sort of come to power in different places like Argentina and Greece and so on. But Poland had sort of gone the other way. Andy mentioned that a minute ago as well. Perhaps a bit surprisingly, perhaps. But it would have been interesting to get the take on this from the member we've got who lives in Poland, Marek. He hasn't been on this these discussions for quite some time now, but it would be interesting to maybe ask him to come on and say something about the situation in Poland and sort of, you know, what this sort of new government means to Poland and to the area generally, because Poland is in such an important strategic position in that part of the world. I mean, it could sort of push things one way or the other in terms of the way the system works anyway in that area. Yeah, that was an interesting result. And, well, to me anyway, pretty unexpected. I thought, if anything, Poland was going further in the opposite direction.
Yeah, I'll bring you in, Andy, and just to respond to that. I mean, my first thought about Poland was, well, they're wanting to get sort of more snuggly and cosy with the EU and with NATO, because they're effectively, well, they feel like they're on the front line. I mean, this last year, they've spent an absolute fortune on new armaments. They placed a $13 billion order with South Korea for tanks, planes, howitzers, all sorts of stuff. Plus, they've ordered other stuff from America, I think. So I thought, oh well, maybe that's why it's gone a bit left wing. But then look at Finland, which has gone right wing after only having joined NATO. So I think my logic doesn't really add up. So possibly it's national government elections, you know, don't really affect, you know, strategic military considerations in the way that, you know, people think. So, yeah, I don't know. Andy, sorry, I've kept you waiting. Go on.
Oh, it's no big deal, thanks. I really was prompted to put my hand up to say was, I'm sure I heard coverage of the situation in Azerbaijan. I don't want to come across as a cheerleader for the BBC World Service, but honestly, it is pretty good a lot of the time, and they did report on this. They came at it from a sort of, reporting about the victims of it rather than the strategic, materialistic, you know, sort of aspects. It was covered in there. And also, I think, both Howard and Paddy, you're a bit like me, really. I think we're quite perplexed about what's going on with this left-wing, right-wing flip-flop. And perhaps maybe I'm, in my own case, overthinking it, and people just think, well, we're pissed off with that lot that we've had for the last however long, and let's try the other lot, you know, which seems to be the way it will be over here in the UK.
Thanks, Andy. I'm sure you're right. I'm sure you're right. That is all it is. Just to say, I think the World Service is famously relied upon by sort of listeners right around the world as being, you know, one of the most or one of the more unbiased news sources. I always tend to think the BBC is at its best in terms of bias when it's talking about other countries that Britain's got no direct interest in, and it's at its worst when it's talking about Britain itself and its interests. But be that as it may, I would also recommend, if I hadn't mentioned it before, there's a daily weekday podcast by The Economist called The Intelligence, which is free. They do other podcasts, but they're behind a paywall now, although it's pretty cheap paywall. It's sort of £2 a month. But the daily podcast is free, and what I like about The Economist is it does look at the material sort of motivations behind things, because, well, you know, they're all about money, aren't they? So, you know, they do tend to look into what's behind this, what is going on with the oil, what is going on with the gas, sort of thing, which you tend not to see in other news sources. So they, even though I suppose you might regard The Economist as sort of pro-capitalist and, you know, right-wing to an extent, it does have this sort of materialist approach that is quite in keeping with our own sort of viewpoint. You know, they analyse things much the same we would, so I think they're pretty good, like a good source for us. Dougie next. Dougie.
Hi Paddy, I was just watching something online. A Conservative MP saying these marches about Gaza aren't British or whatever, you know, and blaming immigration on it, and saying immigration's failed, and, you know, it's not multicultural society anymore, and all the rest of it. And I think there seems to be a big thing in the world about immigration. If you look at what's happening in America, you know, with the Mexico border and things, and immigration in this country. I mean, you get GB News and people like that calling them hate marchers and things like that when they're trying to just march for a ceasefire in Gaza or whatever. So, I mean, I don't know what they mean by British values if 7,000 children are killed by the Israelis and people are marching against that, and that's not part of British values according to the Conservatives. But I mean, I think there is a thing about using immigration to get votes, really, you know, saying they're tough on it and all the rest of it. And I suppose the Conservatives have got into a fuss about Rwanda or whatever, you know. I mean, that's never going to work, and I think they probably know that now, and they've thrown millions of pounds at it. But I mean, I think some people fall for this, you know. You divide the workers, and, you know, immigrants are bad, and, you know, they're all economic migrants, and we don't have room for them and things. So you get all that kind of thing, and I think GB News is probably like that in this country. You know, they talk about hate marches and things like that, and support a right wing agenda, right, with the people they have on the programme. So I don't know. I'm just rambling a bit now, so I'll leave it at that. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. Thanks, Lee. Just two things on that. I think I got these from The Economist today. One is that immigration in Britain has gone up since Brexit, which I think is really hilarious. You know, anyone who voted Brexit to keep the foreigners out must be really kicking themselves right now. And I allow myself a certain schadenfreude over that. But the other thing they were saying, which was interesting, is that wages are going up in most advanced capitalist countries. There's an upward trend in wages simply because there's a shortage of labour. And what they were saying was this shortage of labour cannot be... The shortage of labour is acute in places like Japan because of the declining population. You know, there's an ageing population, and almost all populations around the world are declining or static, including China, as is well known. And so what's happening is that, you know, this is creating a shortage of labour. And what they said was this could not be corrected even with immigration. So even if you just sort of opened all the gates and just said, yeah, come on, you know, more the merrier, you still wouldn't get enough in to make up for the shortfall of labour, which would then sort of depress wages. So, you know, people who are anti-immigration are just really, you know, not following, you know, the real facts, frankly. Anybody else? Howard again.
If no one's going to say anything else, I'll say a couple of brief words on two things, really, which may give people sort of, you know, materials to sort of expand on. First of all, you didn't say a great deal, Paddy, but why should you have done about what's been happening politically in Britain? I mean, to take up something that Andy said, you know, the question of how come there are these sort of various changes of government in different places, some in one direction, some in another. I mean, it's what this, I keep sort of quoting this, this sort of old friend of mine used to say, and that was governments are not elected, they are dismissed. In other words, people get fed up with governments inevitably because they can't run the system. The system runs them. But people nevertheless blame them when things go wrong. And therefore they think, well, we'll try the other one next time, see if they can do any better. They don't, of course. We know that. And that's very much what's happening at the moment in this country, isn't it? I mean, it's just got worse and worse and worse for the Tory party. And people look around, what's the alternative? The only alternative they see is Labour. And for that reason, it seems very likely indeed that Labour will come to power at the next election, whenever that election is held, either earlier or later. So that's the first sort of observation I wanted to make. The other thing is the states. Yeah, as you said, Paddy, it's quite remarkable that despite being sort of manifestly demented, Donald Trump seems likely to become the next president. I find it very hard to credit indeed that there are quite so many people in the USA who don't see this or aren't sort of fazed by this and will be prepared to vote for him in their millions come, when is it, November? Good grief. I mean, we may say, and we would say, that it won't make a lot of difference because the system is the system, whoever's in power, but I think probably all of us here would be pretty perturbed one way or the other if it were to happen, because heavens, you know, the consequences for many individuals, not just in the United States but elsewhere, I mean, could be quite catastrophic. You know, worse, I think, almost certainly than if his opponent, whether it's Biden or somebody else, were to be elected. I don't know what people think of that idea. But anyway, just to say a word about that now.
Yeah, thanks, Howard. I suppose, just to respond quickly to that, is I think the one thing that a lot of people would be concerned about is if Trump got in, America would do a complete 180 on its climate commitments, and that could sort of spearhead a charge away from the green agenda right across the world. And you know, when we're in the situation that we're in, with every single year being the hottest on record, you know, for that to happen right now, you know, could be, I think, I mean, he did it the last time he was in, of course. You know, he just turned his back on, Paris 2015, just said, right, we're not having anything to do with that. And, and then he'd have 4 years of America just pulling out, and China's only just got on board with this, you know, and they'll just go, well, sorry, if America's not doing it, we're not going to do it either. And then, like I say, there'll be a charge away from it, which I think the world can ill afford at the moment. Anyway, Joel's next. Joel?
Hiya, good evening, everyone. I know you touched on Gaza right at the start, but what's been the coverage like of that, of the Israeli lad who said he wouldn't join the armed forces?
Just remind me, Joel, which Israeli lad is this?
I saw some in the paper earlier on in the week, and it was about an Israeli lad. He said he wouldn't join the armed forces.
I think I vaguely remember a story like that. Does anybody else remember this story?
I just wondered if there's been, what the coverage's been like on it. I mean, it's healthy to hear that he wouldn't doesn't want to join the armed forces.
I mean, there has been coverage of the number of people. I think it's 90,000 from Ukraine.
Hmm.
Or some, no, wait a minute, it's probably more than that from Ukraine, but 90,000 Russians left Russia to avoid the draft, and a lot of them ended up in, oddly enough, Azerbaijan, where we were just talking. So
how many have left?
I I seem to remember the number 90,000, which in terms of the size of Russia's population isn't that significant, but it's a fair few.
Yeah.
So I suppose you'd probably get that in, well, any war, wouldn't you? Sort of.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, a minority will just say, well, I'm not doing this.
You know, yeah.
Quite rightly so, really.
Can I just say there's been some reporting of Israeli casualties that I've seen last week or two. Not huge, but nevertheless, you know, a good few Israeli soldiers have died. And you can imagine there'd be quite a few people in a country like Israel and think, I'm not going to fight because I might die.
I
mean, other people are going to take a different view. They're going to say, I'm fighting for the, you know, for my country and my people and so on. But you're going to get from all sorts of sort of sides of the fence who are going to say, no, you know, I don't want to die now. I'm not going to fight, and whatever the consequences are. I mean, what's going to happen to them anyway? They may get put in prison, they may get ostracized or whatever, but, you know, better than sort of dying on the battlefield is the way that they'll probably look at it.
Yeah, I mean the government is hell-bent on continuing in sort of destroying Hamas. I mean, that's what they keep saying. And it's how long are they going to keep saying that for? Because it costs money to run a war.
Okay, I'll just go over to Andy, but just before I do, I just remembered, there was a news story just the other day that, this senior Hamas guy has just been bumped off, hasn't he?
That's right.
Where was it? In Beirut. So it's generally accepted it was Israel that did it, although they're not admitting it. So now there's a, you know, potential escalation if Hezbollah get involved. So, you know, Israel are absolutely not taking any prisoners here at all. Andy, back to you.
Yeah, just a quick thing, really. I just would like to say that the Socialist Party's got a rich tradition of conscientious objection. And during the wars previously, during the main wars, the what's known as the First World War and the Second World War, party members were imprisoned for objecting and refusing to fight their fellow workers.
Okay, thank you, Andy. Freddie next. Freddie, hands up.
Okay, yeah, thanks, Paddy. Just picking up on what Joel was saying there, I saw that same report that Joel spoke about, where there was a number of Israelis were refusing to take up this national service, apparently, that they're obliged to do. But on top of that, it was also on Al Jazeera TV about a week ago now, it was on Al Jazeera, that there was a demonstration in Tel Aviv with a combination of Israelis and Palestinians opposing the war. Now, the crowd that was sort of surrounding them were quite sort of hostile to them. But nonetheless, these individuals were standing up and saying, listen, you know, this has got to stop. And the Israeli chap that they were talking to said that that Israel should be not looking to extend its borders, etc., into Gaza, which is exactly what it is they're trying to do. I mean, they're trying to take over the country in its entirety. And I think this has been transparent for some length of time now. They looked to it, because it was even today, it was on the news to the effect that that Israel would want to have sort of overall control in Gaza. I can't remember this Israeli spokesperson, but you know, I mean, what an absolutely obnoxious character this particular hawk, if you want to call them that, and I think we know what they mean by that, this particular sort of hawk, was really absolutely obnoxious. Then again, there's a lot of other people quite obnoxious, I know that. But I mean, I was quite encouraged that in the last week or two, that certainly on Al Jazeera, I haven't seen it reported elsewhere, that that some Palestinians and Israelis have got their heads together and protesting as to what's going on. So I think that's something which we're encouraged about. And as Andrew says, you know, the conscientious objectors in Israel itself as well, in addition to this individual. So I think there's some degree of encouragement there in the sense that you're an everyday person and not the the state's people or spokespeople for the state, the Israel state, are beginning to get a voice. But I mean, there's little doubt also in my mind that you can draw similarities to what Israel's up to just now. And when Hong Kong, for example, was handed over, or the Chinese took over the Hong Kong donkeys years ago, they were promised all sorts of, yeah, everything would be the same. And China's now perpetrating, and has perpetrated for some length of time, exercising total control and limiting the amount of democracy that there is or was in Hong Kong. So, as I say, though, I think there's still room for encouragement that some workers are at perhaps great peril to themselves voicing their opinion that this has got to stop. So that's my contribution. Thanks.
Okay. All right. Thanks, Freddie. I was I was just looking at, while you were saying that, I was just looking at Al Jazeera. I can't find a reference to that story you were saying, although they do have one about Jewish protesters shutting down the California Assembly, calling for a Gaza ceasefire. These are anti-Zionist Jewish groups, and I sort of yeah, it's interesting that you probably aren't going to see that reported in Western news media. So, although, I mean, also I can't help wondering, I mean, Al Jazeera is based in Qatar, but that's where a lot of the Hamas leaders live as well, in luxury apartments. So I'm not quite sure how independent Al Jazeera is in this particular instance, although they're generally reliable on when they're talking about Western sort of political events. But just on this particular one, I can't help wondering.
You know. Well, Paddy, I mean, all I'm looking at, yeah, but I mean, what I'm looking at was the film of some Israeli and the film of a Palestinian, both involved in a demonstration. Now, I don't think Al Jazeera could doctor it up to that extent.
Oh no, I don't mean they were doing doctoring. No. I was just saying I couldn't find it. But if you've got a link, that would be maybe handy.
Oh well, it's the same as it was last week. In fact, I actually mentioned it on Facebook last week when I saw it, but I didn't take the link from it, Paddy. I didn't think to take the link from it. So yeah.
No, I'm sure.
I'll maybe try and think about it.
No, I mean, we can see, like they do, like I say, they've got this story about the California legislature and some anti-Zionist Jewish groups there. So, yeah, I just wonder how much opposition to the war there is inside Israel and whether that would even be reported by Western news media, given that, you know, Western capitalist states are sort of four square behind Israel. And you know, we've just sort of discussed this before, and it's not because they even necessarily really give a shit about Israel. You know, the concern here once again is oil and gas, and You know, the concern is that Russia and China are just becoming too influential in the Middle East, in particular in Iran. So, yeah, it just seems to come down to that again. Anybody else? We've got the Socialist Party itself wants to speak. Who's that?
Hello, it's me for some reason. I think because I hosted a previous meeting in Glasgow.
Oh.
I've become the Socialist Party.
Okay, John. Yeah, when you're not going to host, don't log into Zoom, because I think it creates some problems if two of us log in at the same time, or it does sometimes. But just come in the normal way.
But, yeah, well, yeah. That's what I thought I had done, but it seemed to, by default, it asked me, did I want to take over the host? And I said, no, I wanted to remain a participant. Okay. But for some reason, it called me the Socialist Party.
Oh,
but
you know, you can change your name if you right-click on where it says the Socialist Party. If you right-click on that, there's a rename option, so you can just give yourself your name back.
All right. Oh, well, that's,
anyway,
that's handy.
Anyway, carry on, John, carry on.
Yes, I was thinking about all the problems that are going on with the Houthis, which are causing a bit of a problem for the Western capitalists, about a sort of an alliance of about a dozen different states, including Britain, the United States, Australia, Italy. Some others, you know, there's about a dozen or so, and they're all saying, they've issued a statement to these people saying, by the way, don't expect another warning. If you do this again, we're going to obliterate you. So that shows, that just emphasises the concern of these powers about the trade routes that are under threat by the Houthis, who think they're acting in the interests of the Palestinians. That's their alleged motivation for this. So yeah, it was just to basically say that's a real threat. That could extend the war, perhaps, if something happens to these Houthis as a result of what they've been doing, and others then feel obliged to get involved. I mean, everybody, all the greater powers are kind of reluctant for it to be extended for obvious reasons, but at the same time, wars have got a habit of getting out of control, and this is what might happen. This has to obviously be a worry. Thanks.
Okay, thanks, John. Yeah, I mean, with the Houthis, this is a clever power play, essentially by Iran, because the Houthis, yeah, they've launched a few rockets, and I think they did hit a tanker or a glancing blow. I don't think they did a huge amount of damage, but it was enough to scare off the major shipping companies. So Maersk and these other huge shipping companies have just said, right, well, we're not going to do it. We're just avoiding the Red Sea. But, I mean, there's a huge amount of trade goes through that. I don't know, is it 50% or 40% of world trade or something like that? And so for the big shipping companies to back off, because the, you know, America has got fleets in the area, but and China's got a base at Djibouti, just on the Horn of Africa, just overlooking the Red Sea. But they can't sort of, against drones, you know, they're a bit. Iran and the Houthis have probably got thousands of drones, and I think I read a thing the other day that said, you know, a drone costs, what, £100? One of these things, a couple of hundred, you can just send up loads of them. The missiles that take these drones down cost about £1 million or $1 million or something like that. So all they've got to do is keep flying drones, and it's going to cost the Western powers, by which I mean America, Israel, Saudi Arabia, which is, you know, part of this gang, every time drones go over, it costs them a fortune. So It's quite clever, and it doesn't, and they don't even need to do very much before the big capitalist merchant fleets decide to stay the hell out of the Red Sea. So, you know, it's one of those, they're basically holding Western capitalism to ransom. So it's a clever move by them. Sorry, I've banged on enough. So Pat's next. Pat, do you want to say something?
Right. Well, on this about not all of the Jews do support these terrible things that's happening in Gaza, but I did understand that in Israel, the news media doesn't show pictures of what is happening, of what is being done there. Though with communications these days, it wouldn't be so easy to keep what's happening in one place from out another. But it's very hard to see it. It's a sort of unbelievable that this sort of is going on all the time, and then the news passes to, you know, what something else is happening in the country here, and you know, it's just sort of strange. And on that, and Israeli government spokesman have pointed out that the US have done similar things when they were dealing with IS, I think, there's a particular a town or city or whatever it was in Iraq where, and I think it began with F, but I cannot remember what it was, but they did this very you know, devastating things there. But it's very hard to think of these things, and I use the word acceptable because I can't sort of think of another word. It's not quite the right word that war is sort of accepted as you know, something that can carry on, and people I've spoken to, and I don't go out much, so I don't, you know, don't see many people, but people I have spoken to, you're just helpless. You don't understand how it can carry on as it does. But the other last thing, going off a complete tangent, I think we haven't mentioned the death of John Pilger, who was extremely good at the films and so on that he made, and pointing out the not the sort of popular views and very informative on things, and particularly on the Israel and the Palestinian problems there. I think that you know, he's not a socialist, but on the other hand, you know, so many people aren't. But I think that he did do a very useful job in the way that he put out information. That's it. Thank you, Paddy.
Thanks, Pat. Yeah, that's a good point. Actually, I noticed John Pilger had an obituary in The Guardian, which was very nice about him, but a bit hypocritical, because The Guardian actually banned John Pilger, sacked him for basically being too left-wing, not, you know, as you say, not socialist as we'd understand, but certainly far too strong medicine for the likes of The Guardian. And yeah, he was, for a long time, for decades actually, he was a sort of conscience of the working class in a sense. And yeah, who we've got nowadays that sort of fills his shoes, I can't even think. So, yeah.